Good morning, everyone. I'm calling to order the Committee for Judiciary in the Senate. At this point, I want to kind of put down some frameworks as to how we're going to proceed today. We have a number of individuals who will be testifying. We also have a limitation on the amount of time that we have. And so what I'm going to be working with is a list of those who want to give testimony that have been predetermined by the proponents. And I also need to make certain we have time for those who are on the opposite side. And as staff is bringing forward that list, I understand we have a couple people that may be listed on there. So what I'm going to do to start off with, so I just have a feeling, if you have not signed up on the witness registration, or if you are not with the proponents that have been pre-ordered as to the testimony, could you just raise your hand so I know people who haven't signed up that may want to be giving testimony so I can make certain we allot enough time. All right, so what I see at this point, no one is that's in the room is currently scheduled to testify that hasn't even got on the witness list or is with the pre-scheduled testimony from the proponents. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 307. Council, give us an overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 307 increases the statute of ultimate repose for product liability actions. It applies retroactively unless a judgment was entered in circuit court before the enactment date. The Dash 1 amendment removes manufactured homes from the proposed increase, and the Dash 2 amendment increases the statute of ultimate repose from 8 years, the current limit, to 25 years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, and before we take testimony, I just want to make sure everyone understands at this point what we are going to be doing is taking testimony and only testimony. We will not be going into work session at this point. I expect there's going to be significant testimony that we will, as a committee, want to digest, and we will then take it from there as to what happens next. So with that, I have an order of individuals that will be coming forward to testify. Linda Ehrman, I believe you're going to be here and help with the presentations on the first three individuals. And so the first one I'm calling up with you, Linda, come on up, please. I have Jason Reynolds. And what I'm going to do, Linda, I'm going to go ask if we can go ahead and get maybe Stephen Sharp up to the table as well, and that will help us facilitate through this process. And Linda, did you want to give an overview as to where we're going and then have Jason and then Stephen speak?
Yes.
And the other thing that I'm planning on doing is we're going to play by ear. Normally what I do is have testimony come in and then we open up the questions for the whole panel. I'll ask my colleagues whether they want to handle it a little different this day, because I understand each of these individuals will be talking specifically about a situation or their personal stories. All right, Linda?
Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Linda Ehrman. I'm a lawyer from Portland and a past president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And I want to thank you for having this hearing and allowing us to present testimony here today on Senate Bill 307 and particularly the Dash 2 amendments. This is an access to justice bill, and what this bill does is it allows citizens of Oregon who've been injured by defective products to have their day in court. The way that the law works now is when a person is injured in Oregon by a defective product, they have 2 years from the date of the injury, or 3 years if it's a death, to bring their lawsuit. But the product can be no older than 8 years at the time that the injury occurs. What this bill would do is it would keep the 2 and 3 year statute of limitations, but it would extend the statute of ultimate repose, or the 8 years, out to 25 years. So the product could be no more than 25 years at the time the injury occurs. And we feel this is important because it is more consistent with the representations that manufacturers make about products, or some products certainly at the time they sell them, and the expectations that consumers have about how long products will last. We've done a 50-state analysis, and 37 states have no product age limit or statute of ultimate repose. They have a statute of limitations for bringing a case, and then it is simply a matter of proof at trial as to whether the product is still within its useful life. The 13 states that do have some kind of statute of ultimate repose, Oregon is the second shortest or most restrictive anti-consumer provision in the entire country. Only North Carolina has a shorter statute of repose, and that is 6 years. There have been exceptions made by this legislature over the years, most of them with bipartisan support, when the legislature has seen how unfair this statute can be to a particular Oregon citizen or group of citizens. And the example that sticks out is the side saddle gas tanks, where a woman from Central Oregon in Senator Bryant and Representative Clarno's district was seriously burned and her grandchild was killed by one of these side saddle gas tank accidents. She was able to get justice in Oregon because the legislature eliminated the statute of repose for that particular product. But we believe that a product-by-product approach is not only poor policy, but it is really not practical for an Oregon citizen, particularly someone seriously injured, to have to come to the legislature, make their case, and possibly get an exception. So we have here today to testify several people in support of the bill. I would first like to introduce Jason Reynolds, who is the director of the Oregon Consumer Justice Alliance.
Chairman Pazanski and members of the committee, thanks for having me here to testify. I'm again speaking on behalf in yes in Senate Bill 307. Our law now, and some of this is what
I need you just for the record to state your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's Jason Reynolds, Consumer Justice Alliance.
Yes.
Oregon law is the second worst in the country.
Virtually any place else, if
you're hurt by a defective product, you have more time or as much time as you need. You have to do the lawsuit, but the life of the product is more the issue. Farm tractors and other appliances that last 20, 30 years, if there's a defect in that product that does not show up until 8 or 9 years, which happens, you're out of luck in Oregon. You might as well go to any other state except North Carolina, and you'll be all set. 38 states have no limit at all. The useful life of the product is what they consider. If it's supposed to last 30 years and it's terrible at year 20, you still can do something about it. And then in a few states, there's some limitation. We would argue that 25 would give protection for most Oregonians. And that's what I'm here to present, and that's about it.
All right, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and take testimony from Stephen. Stephen, if you'll identify yourself and go ahead and give us your story.
All right. Basically, when I was in high school, my name is Steve Sharp.
Great. Thank you.
Nice to see you guys. Basically, when I was in high school, I took a job at baling hay, and I was running a Case 970 tractor. Basically, there's a problem with the BTO system. The thing will turn on when not expected. It has to be just in a certain position for it to actually do it. I've never seen it do it before. But basically, I was back there at the baler taking some hay out from in front of the rollers, when the thing started, and it grabbed both my hands. Pulled them into the baler, and basically, over time, just ground them off. Once I got loose from the baler, I walked up to the house and had the guys working for call the ambulance. They came and got me. They took me to Portland, to OHSU, where they basically just did skin grafts and different stuff on my stumps. The arms were pretty much ruined. So then I went to Shriners Hospital, where they gave me my first prosthetic, taught me how to use it and all that. Throughout the years, I've spent a lot of time with attorneys doing, different things like this. Here in the state of Oregon, my attorneys told me we didn't have a case. The tractor was over 20 years old. Heavy equipment's used for a lot more years than that. But they said that it was too old in the state of Oregon. It was like 8 years or something. So basically, my attorneys told me that in Wisconsin, where the tractor was manufactured, they didn't have an amount of time for the product. So we went to Wisconsin, and we sued the tractor company there. We basically had a jury trial to begin with, and we won the jury trial. Then over the next, probably 6 or 7 years, it went through the Wisconsin appellate courts and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And at the end, they finally found for me. One of the biggest obstacles that we had to overcome was they wanted Oregon law to apply. Since the accident happened in Oregon, I lived in Oregon, all that. But Wisconsin found that they had acted in a wrong way. There was a couple other gentlemen, one gentleman that actually was killed by the piece of equipment. Another guy actually had his right arm mangled from it. And that was probably 10 or 15 years before my accident. And they had sent nothing out stating that this thing could do this, didn't tell the dealers, didn't tell anybody, basically just let it go. And even after we won in Wisconsin, they've sent nothing out stating that this thing can do that. So now I basically, I farm. I've got pretty good with the hook. I got guns rigged up where I can shoot them, and I drive tractors and put up the crops and stuff. Basically why I'm here today is it took a lot of time and a lot of effort going to Wisconsin to get my day in court, and I'm here to try to see if we can get other plaintiffs to have their day here in Oregon.
Stephen, thank you very much. I want to open up the panel for any questions, if anyone has any questions. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Stephen, thank you for being here. I actually read the book about your story and really admire your strength and courage getting through this. Can you just tell us a little bit about what it was about the baler that was the problem?
There's a pump in there that runs hydraulic fluid through it, and it looks like a pencil that's inside of it, and that moves back and forth and has a groove cut in it. And basically, when that groove is moved over, it allows fluid to go through over to some clutches, pushes the clutches together, which makes the implement behind you run. And basically what happens is that spindle, that pencil thing with the groove, won't be all the way back. It'll be just a little bit forward. It's forward enough to build up for that fluid to get in there and build up pressure. Then it moves the spindle forward, then lets that fluid through to the clutches, and then when it engages, it's engaged all the way.
So just a quick follow-up, to clarify, so it would turn on even though you turned it off?
Yes, basically you would pull the handle back, and the implement behind you would quit running, and you would get off it and be back there by it, and then it would start. And that, in all actuality, the thing isn't all the way in off. They say, well, the handle has to be all the way back. And all the other times I got the handle all the way back, or this time I hit the back of it and it moved forward. But the implement behind you stops moving. So you think it's off. It's kind of a trap. So then I went back there and basically got caught in it. The guy I was working for had seen this happen before, but didn't think anything of it. He was just driving down the road and seen it was on, so he just wiggled the handle, and the thing quit. And he said he never had it happen after that. So it has to be just in a certain position for it to do this. And times before, I just never had it in that position.
Thank you.
So, Stephen, I'm going to follow up, and that's basically you're talking about this is a hydraulic system, and that the hydraulic fluid was able to pass. And do you know the design as to what they, I understand that they had notice of this through other instances, what was actually needed to fix it? Was it like an O-ring, or was it something, and just how the piston rod was set in there that it couldn't be fully disengaged?
Basically, yes, they had knowledge that this was happening. They had letters sent in. We had farmers that wrote letters stating that they wrote letters to the tractor company stating that they had it self-start when it was new. And also they had records that they had clutch plate warpage. Basically, that means that fluid was leaking around and those clutches weren't all the way pushed together,
right,
so that they were getting hot and they were warping. So what they did is they actually took a spring and they hooked it on the handle and then hooked it on the back of the console on some later models, trying to stop the clutch plate warpage. But the way that they had put it on there was just kind of piecemeal. The thing broke within, no time. And
so. All right. Thank you. Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify for the record, Stephen can correct me if I'm in error. We're talking about the power takeoff unit on the tractor itself.
Well,
the baler did the injury. It's the tractor itself, right. Power takeoff that was faulty.
And everyone understands power takeoff is the direct drive of actually making these apparatuses work off the engine.
I think I understand as much as I need to.
We'll go into diesel mechanics later. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you all very, very much for coming forward. Stephen, again, thank you for coming today. All right. Our next panel is going to include, I guess we got Amber Newcomb. Let's see, is that right? Yeah, Amber. Please come on up, and this will conclude the first three sets, and then we'll move on from there. And Linda, did you have something else that you wanted in the presentation?
I would like to introduce Amber, Chair Prozanski, and members of the committee. Might I make 3 points just in follow-up of Stephen Sharp's testimony? Would that be all right?
Quickly.
I just wanted to point out that the book that Senator Bonamici mentioned, we have a copy of it, and we would be glad to loan it to the committee as a resource while this bill is being considered if there's any additional questions about how the accident happened or the steps that Stephen needed to go through to get justice in another state. So I would make that
Thank you for making that available, and if someone wants to borrow it, we'll get a library card and issue it to them.
And so we'll get it back eventually. Second, I wanted to make clear that Senate Bill 307 doesn't change anything about products liability law, how it is now, what type of proof needs to be presented, who has the burden of proof, anything except it allows someone who's injured to bring a claim in Oregon if the product is between 8 and 25 years old. It makes no other change in the law. Finally, I wanted to point out that a case like Stevens, where he is able to hold a product manufacturer accountable because of a defect in its product, has the potential of having a positive fiscal impact on the state of Oregon. Stephen's injury occurred when he was on the job, and his medical bills and time loss were all covered by his workers' comp carrier that was SAFE. When the 8 years passed in Oregon, SAFE, well, I should back up and say, workers' comp carriers, including SAFE, have a right to be repaid if there is a third-party recovery. And their right, of course, goes along with the length of the claim, and after 8 years, if there's no claim, they don't get paid back. In Stephen's case, since he was able to obtain a recovery from the manufacturer of the tractor, he was required to and did pay SAFE back in, to the tune of several hundred thousand dollars that had been paid out. And I did want to make that point clear.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Amber?
Now, I'd like to introduce Amber Newcomb.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Amber Newcomb, and I'm from Central Point, Oregon. When I was 9 years old, about 11 years ago, my family had bought a new white Westinghouse top loader washer, and I was putting towels in the washing machine, and the agitator was still going as I had lifted the lid, and the towels had wrapped around my arm, which had the washing machine snap my arm in half and broken the bone, and I was rushed to Dornbecker Hospital to receive 9 surgeries to try and reattach my right arm. The following 3 weeks, I spent months in the hospital trying to reattach my arm, trying to get physical therapy. And the reason that my washing machine failed was because the machine lacked a piece to have the agitator stop when you lifted the lid. This piece only cost $1 for the company per machine. And if they would have just put that, spent that $1 to put the piece in the machine, then I would still have my right arm. Since 2001, we had the company continue to make their products with the piece in the machine so that agitator would stop upon opening the lid. But all the machines since 1985 to 2001 are still out there. We could not get them to have a recall. And this could still happen for anybody who owns these machines. Those machines now are over 8 years old. And for people who could possibly get in a similar accident to mine, they would not be able to seek justice and hold the company responsible for what these machines can do to them. So I support this bill because this is what needs to be done. When people create something, you need to be held for responsible for what you create. You need to know how to manage it, and if bad stuff happens from a machine you create, you need to be able to fix it.
Amber, thank you. Questions? Thank you very, very much for coming forward today and sharing your story with us.
Might I share something with the committee? I was Amber's lawyer, and Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. She really had an extraordinary case. Because her family's washing machine was relatively new, she was able to bring a lawsuit in Oregon. And during the course of the lawsuit, we discovered that the company, which was White Westinghouse, owned by Frigidaire, had been making the same design of top-loading washing machine from 1985 without a lid switch, and that there were literally hundreds of thousands of washing machines out there that lacked this safety feature. Amber's family was totally devoted to the idea that this not happen to someone else, and because of their fortitude, we were able to settle the case with an agreement from the manufacturer that they would change the design of the machine going forward. And as Amber said, starting in December of 2001, every washing machine that came off the assembly line of the plant had the safety feature that was lacking. So Amber and her family were able to make through a products liability case, were able to make this product safer for the future. The concern is that we could not get them to recall the product, and so there still are in Oregon, I would say thousands of washing machines out there that when you open the lid, they continue to agitate and present the same kind of risk to other children and consumers as Amber encountered. That's our concern.
Thank you again, Amber. All right, I have a group of teachers, and we need to bring, I think, one additional chair up. And my understanding, these individuals are Denise Fletter, Mary Borg, Sherry Rhodes, and Joel LaFollette, excuse me. And I'm going to let you all present in the order that you'd like. So if you just basically, quote unquote, sign in, give us your name before your testimony when you're ready.
Yes, it's me. Hi, Chair Plazanski and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Rhodes, and I am a teacher in Lake Oswego. I'm going to talk, sure you've heard a little bit about the accident. It happened in October of 2004 where a volleyball hit one of the metal halide lights in the gym and broke the clear outer UV protective cover. The light continued to burn and it was not replaced. It happened on a day that I wasn't there. I am the PE teacher at Bryant. I worked there for 32 hours over the next 3 weeks while it was still burning. On November 12th, the district had an in-service for teachers, and after that evening, over 70 teachers went to the emergency with burning eyes, and I had had the same experience weeks before, but I thought I wore contacts and I fell asleep, and I thought it was because my eyes were burning because I had left them in. So I had no idea that this injury was still occurring. Over the course of the time, most of the teachers did recover. However, there are still five of us that are suffering from the exposure. When they tested it, they found out we got a full day's worth of UV exposure every 8 minutes that you were underneath the light. We have been diagnosed with trigeminal neuralgia, and that is severe nerve damage to the cornea. And what that is the nerves in the back of the eyes are normally little straight, three little straight hair-like fractures. And when you look at the picture that they have taken of ours, they branch out like trees. And every one of those little branches are more nerve endings that are there that you feel more pain with. We have extreme light sensitivity and pain. You get any type of light will give you a really migraine headache. And fluorescent lights tend to be the worst. Over the past 4 years, I have had a growth removed from my left eyelid and had to surgically have one of the artificial plugs that were put in to keep fluid on the eyes removed. In 2007, went to the Boston Institute for Sight and were fitted with scleral lenses, which are a big lens that keep fluid on the eye to keep the cornea from cracking and tearing. I wear sunglasses every day to work, even though I have 20 lights in my gym and there are now 9 on. It's like candlelight, but that's the most light that I can handle in there. My visor. Anytime I go to places where the lights are too bright, you'll automatically get sick at your stomach and have to leave, and then the migraines will come where you'll have to go into a dark room and just wait until it gets over with. It's totally changed my life. I don't read anymore because I can't read, can't see very well. The light off the page is really hard. Working on a computer is hard, doing grades. I love teaching, I love reading, but it's really hard, and I don't know how much longer I can continue this. In September, my doctor put me on part-time because I couldn't handle being there every day, so I'm working 24 hours in a week, 3 days. And I'm just concerned what my future is going to be like. I don't know. My husband doesn't know what's going to happen. I have two kids in college. Financially, you know, if I have to quit work or if with the state's, you know, financial woes that they have, if my job is no longer available, I'm not sure what we'll do. That's just where I'm concerned. My husband now asks, usually when your husband says, how are you in the morning, first thing he says is, how are your eyes today? Anything we do has to be with, how are your eyes? We can't go where we can't. We don't go places because if I'm not feeling up to it, then I usually stay home. And that's where my story ends. Hand off next. Questions? Sorry.
Yeah. Committee, I don't know if you want to ask Sherry any questions directly at this point, or do you want to hear from the other individuals? All right. We'll go ahead and take the whole panel, then we'll open it up, because I think some of the questions are going to be more generic as compared to specifics.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here. My name is Denise Fletter. I live in Westland, Oregon, but I'm also one of the teachers from Lake Oswego School District. I was in the gymnasium that day for the in-service. I believe I was one of the first ones to go to the emergency room that night because after leaving school that night, I knew that I was in a lot of pain. We had no idea what was happening, what had caused it, or the fact that our eyes continued to burn even after we were out of the gym. And I got into a car accident because of it. When I got on the freeway, all the lights were running together. I was still completely unaware of what was happening. I was scared to death, but I didn't know what was happening. When I went to the emergency room, the doctors thought I had pink eye, an infection in my eye, because my eyes were completely red. And I kept telling them I knew I didn't have that. I was just in extreme pain. And the doctors did not know what was happening. Anyway, for the past 4.5 years, all I've done was try to focus on healing. The pain has never gone away. Every single day, all day, and all night, we are in constant pain. It affects our sleep, and it affects, as Sherry said, every single thing that we do. And there are a lot of triggers that cause more pain to our eyes and cause the outer layer to be damaged even more. As Sherry said, the lights bother us. Reading causes pain. Air moving causes pain. And it causes extreme burning in my eyes. I often feel like I'm blinking over sandpaper. And then the headaches. The headaches have become debilitating for me. They are daily. And every day is just a question, is it going to be just a regular headache or a migraine headache that leads to nauseous and vomiting? And what has happened for me is that teaching is my calling. I love teaching. I think it's the best job in the world. And I have tried so hard to continue working and do what I love to do. To the expense of my family, I have 3 children, one who turned 1 year old that weekend. She's now 5. My middle son is 11, and my oldest daughter is just turned 16. She has become like a second mother to the younger ones because there's so much that I can't do. When I get home from work and I'm in so much pain, she then takes over for me. She's the one that ends up reading to the children or helping with dinner or, you know, when my husband comes home, helping him get the kids ready for bed. She's become a godsend to me in a way that she shouldn't have to be. All of my children and my husband have paid the price as much as I have, I think. And now, this year, I face a new challenge in that the doctors are telling me I'm not going to get better. I'm never going to get better. And not only that, I've gotten worse. It has gotten worse every year to the point where my doctor said, you cannot keep doing this. You cannot keep going to work and tearing up your eyes and going home and having no life. And so as of the end of January, they made me quit teaching. And so right now I'm not teaching. And having to deal with the loss of my passion in work, I now also am completely stressed about my financial future. I feel that I have a loss in my financial future. My family depends on my income, and I'm the one that provides our health benefits. And so this is where I'm at now. And having no, I don't even have the chance to go and ask a court for recourse. And I have no options except for to deal with on our own. And so that is why I am here, hoping that you will consider a change in this law. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mary?
Thank you, Senator Prosansky and committee. My name is Mary Nierhaupt-Borg. I'm also one of the teachers that was burned, ironically, 2 months into getting my license, of a life change for me. I went to my first math in service and was burned. The night I woke up at 1 a.m. because the moon through the curtains, through my eyelids, was so excruciatingly bright that I couldn't handle it. And I stumbled around the house looking for sunglasses, which I did not own a pair because sunglasses make me nauseous. They always have. I finally found my husband's and put them on and realized I needed to go to the hospital, where they proceeded to inform me that I must have been using a welding torch that day. And I insisted I had not. I kind of remember things like that. And they said, well, then, were you skiing without goggles? And I said, absolutely not. I was at work. I was just at work. And basically, they described to me the injury as if they had thrown sand in my eye. Every single grain had burned all the way through and was at that point still continuing to burn. Vicodin in the eyes and painkillers got me through the next 2 days, as well as having my head completely taped up and my eyes taped up. I was completely blinded and not knowing what happened. Phillips Light knew what happens because we weren't the first group that this has happened to. They knew. And so when we tracked it down and found out other injuries like this have happened, and Phillips has a track record of this, most of them aren't as severe as ours because most people don't sit under a gym light or that type of light for such an extended period of time. But there are countless people across the country who have suffered this. So Phillips knows and sent us a letter about, too bad you didn't have the self-extinguishing light that kind of goes out when that protective covering is broken. That, to me, shows they know it's a problem. And they also, in that letter, stated it's a more expensive bulb, and we are aware that most people can't afford that bulb, so we have the cheaper one available. But to me, that just shows they know this is a problem, a recognized problem. It's hard in 2 minutes to describe 4.5 years of a downward spiral in terms of emotional and physical pain. Our lives have been changed completely. These two and others have now either part-time or not working. One person who's not here came down with skin cancer on the face from the burns, and she's had repeated surgery. She's also not working. I am working, and people, I've been told I could go part-time, but I'm afraid to go part-time, because as soon as I do that, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm damaged goods. Who else is going to hire me? I'm at a real tough part, it's a spot, and these ladies were there as well. To give up the teaching was not an easy decision for them, because we have nothing out there for us. Who's going to hire a teacher that hasn't read a book for 4.5 years? If you visited my house, it's wall to wall, ceiling to floor bookshelves. I've got thousands of books in my house, and now all I can do is walk by and pet them. I haven't read a book in 4.5 years, and that is unbelievable for me to say that. The impact on family is not small. My family took a vacation to Hawaii. I did not go. Too bright. Photos of my daughter's wedding, I'm not in any of them because flashbulbs are too painful. Driving headlights at night basically feels like a hot nail going down your eyeball, and this is even though you may be wearing sunglasses. little refrigerator bulb, which to you all is nothing, sometimes sends me 2-3 feet jumping back. So the light pain is not minimal. I go to work, and then I go home and in the dark. And every day is a struggle to be in the light. To you, this is probably a dimly lit room. I assure you that the three of us, I've already taken 6 Excedrin migraines today, and I will leave here by the end of this probably quite nauseous. I've already taken the rest of the day off work. The airflow in this room, you may not be noticing it, but my eyes feel like they're on fire. I feel like I'm a superhero, and if I just touch here, I could ignite any part of this room. And that's how my eyes feel all the time. And Phillips knows this. And they know it. They've got reported injuries, and they basically sent us a letter saying they feel they're not responsible. And I feel they are. I'm not asking the state. I understand there must be some financial reason for this sour law put in years ago. But the hardest part of all this is the fact that as an American citizen, I still don't understand how I am denied a day in court. I'm not asking for Oregon to tell Phillips to give me money or anything like that. I'm asking that I can go to court and have my case heard. And the fact that I can't do that is really incomprehensible to me. I would love to have it explained in a way I could understand, my kids could understand, because their lives have been altered because of this. It's incomprehensible, and I think I've said what I needed. Thank you.
Joel. Senator Prozanski, committee, thanks for hearing us today. My name is Joel LaFollette. As you can see, I don't have to wear dark glasses, but yet every day since the incident, those lights have affected my life. My wife was one of the teachers who were injured, and she chose today to attend a continuing education class. She missed one of the 4 classes. She was in Boston for treatment, and so she felt that it was important for her to attend that class today. Her doctors have put her on a schedule where she can work 5 hours a day, 4 days a week, and even that is pushing it. You all are very much aware of the danger that these lights present. Some of you at least, and your colleagues last year voted to remove these lights from Oregon schools. And I want to thank you for that. Because of your efforts, we will not be hearing of other teachers or students or members of the community being injured by these lights. I'd like to kind of add that the reason we are unable to seek justice from Phillips is that the only date that we can associate with the light bulb that did the damage was its date of manufacture, which was 16 years prior to the accident. Now, common sense tells you that a light bulb's not going to burn in a school gymnasium for 16 years. But the fact is that even if it had burned for 16 years, it was working the way it was designed to work. This bulb, the burning of the metal halide filament creates ultraviolet radiation. This outside glass cover is a UV filter. This bulb is designed to continue to burn even if this filter is broken. The radiation that emanated out from below this bulb was equal to 42 days of the recommended UV dosage for the amount of time that the women sat underneath it. And like a sunburn, when you go outside, you go back in, you continue to burn. Your skin continues to burn, and that's what happened. That's what these women experienced. When I came to testify for the bill to remove these lights from Oregon schools, one of the members of the panel asked me why we were not addressing the issue of these lights in box stores, in warehouses, in other places. And I told that individual that you move a mountain one piece at a time. I'm here to start moving the rest of the mountain. Where did those fixtures go when we removed them from Oregon schools? They were probably sold as surplus, and they ended up in riding arenas, barns, warehouses, These bulbs are still injuring people. The only way that we are going to prevent that is to get those bulbs off the market. And the only way we can do that is to make these bulbs too expensive for the companies to produce by making them a liability. We need to be able to go to court and prove that this bulb is dangerous and get them off the market. We need the company to recall these bulbs. Now, we filed a lawsuit in a timely fashion with the 2 years.
We were never allowed our day in court because
the only date we could associate with a light bulb was this date of manufacture. It would be up to us to provide a receipt that showed when that light bulb was purchased and put into service. Well, who keeps a receipt for a light bulb for 8 years? You're not required to keep your tax receipts for more than 7. So the Sauer Law put undue burden on us to produce documentation as to when that light bulb was put into service. Now, the funny thing is, if you can call it funny, is that if that light bulb had been changed 1 week prior to the incident that broke it, the incident would have still happened. It could have been a brand spanking new light bulb that got hit by the volleyball, and it would have done the exact same thing. The teachers would have been injured in the exact same way. There would be no difference. They do make self-extinguishing light bulbs. They have a fusible link that when the outside protecting cover is broken, it shuts off within 15 minutes. It will never turn on again. That part is 5 cents. And they are continuing to build bulbs without it, but most of their production is going into bulbs now that do have that. The fact is that most Oregon schools replace those lights with high-output, energy-efficient fluorescent lights. And so we're saving money. This is a safe claim, a workman's comp claim. That in itself has been a challenge. At one point in time, we were personally out of pocket $10,000 when we sent my wife back to Boston to see if these scleral lens would actually give her some relief. SAFE was not going to pay for it. We talked with our eye doctor. We decided that that was the best course of action. It was our only course of action. She had been out of school for over 7 months, living in a room that we had the windows all taped up. We kept the lights down low. She was only allowed to leave the house when she was going to the doctor. I did everything that had to be done outside the home. SAFE eventually paid for the scleral lenses, and the rest of the women went back to Boston and received the scleral lenses. Maintenance on the scleral lens will require a return to Boston every year at least once for the rest of their lives. In addition to that, my wife's bills for just supplies runs between $400 and $500 a month. Just a very conservative estimate. Just if nothing else goes wrong, we're well over $30,000 a year just in her maintenance. All right. And SAFE is, you know, going to foot that bill. In a time when Oregon is looking for dollars, even though this isn't coming necessarily from the state coffers, it makes sense to me that that companies that are responsible for injuries should be paying for those injuries. They should be paying the medical bills. My wife is, 46? She has a long life ahead of her. And that's a pretty expensive bill. Instead of protecting companies that do harm, we should be protecting Oregonians. And the way we protect Oregonians is to allow them their day in court. I think I've pretty much covered my testimony. Do you have any questions?
Joel, thank you for sharing your story as an individual that's been affected indirectly with this. And ladies, thank you very, very much. I'm going to open up the panel for questions if there are any questions. Again, thank you very much for coming forward today and sharing your stories.
The last person I have scheduled for on the proponent side at this point is Bill Gaylord. And Bill, I'm going to ask you to be focused on your comments and a wrap-up position because I have another panel I need to bring up after that. No, not going to work that way.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to say thank you and waive my time. If there are questions raised by people that are in view of this bill,
I understand. Let me just tell you how.
Entertain you talking, then I'll stick around.
If the committee wants to do that, but what I'm not going to do is have point, counterpoint, rebuttal type of testimony. That's not how I run my committee. So if you have something that you want to share, you can share it now. Or if you want to come back and talk to individual members later on their schedule, you can do that.
I'll do this, and I think I can make a very brief point. I of course, we all come prepared to cover everybody else's subject, and they've been covered. So I've got, I think, one.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Bill Gaylord. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I know from the fact that we've been here, and I've been here in this room and others talking with some of you and your colleagues in previous sessions about various ideas to solve this problem, that there will be a view expressed, if not today, at least in the halls of this building, by business interests who want us to believe that this is an anti-business or anti-Oregon business proposition. I just want to suggest to you that if that's your concern, if you're hearing that from people, please ask them to explain how the Oregon share of the national marketplace, and we all know that products are sold nationally. Oregon products are sold nationally. Wisconsin products are sold nationally. Foreign products and light bulbs are sold nationally. How does the duration of time that a product can be held accountable in Oregon conceivably affect more than a tiny percentage of the business interest in defeating this measure and avoiding responsibility for products? It's not real. Product liability law or product liability marketplace is not an Oregon marketplace. It's a national marketplace. None of the manufacturers who make products, you know, in Oregon or elsewhere, make them with some eye towards what a short time they can be held accountable in Oregon. They have to live with the experience of the 50 states that we've shared with you. And generally speaking, they can be held accountable everywhere else, practically everywhere else. And none of these people that have these concerns before you today would have to have this struggle to get their access to the courthouse.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gaylord, why don't you keep your seat? Mr. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Prusansky. Mr. Gaylord, we have your written testimony from Gunderson Company. They manufacture rail freight cars and ocean-going barges. In this written testimony, it states that their primary competition is in Texas and one other state, which have
Senator Wissett, you're referring to something that's not part of the record, so if you can give us a little bit more identification, because I don't think members have it, and I want to make
it. It came in an email.
It was just handed out to me.
Wasn't handed out.
No, it
email.
Your staff
okay.
Added to it. Your staff.
All right, go ahead. I just want to put it on the record as to where this came from.
Really fine. Anyway, they're suggesting that it would be, cost them an extra $300,000 annual increase in premium for each year added to Oregon's current 10-year statute of ultimate repose. A negative effect on this company, particularly.
I have not seen the document, and I'm not sure what you're talking about, but I get the concept that Gunderson Brothers is saying that it would cost them some number of thousands of dollars in increased liability insurance costs. Is that the thing?
Let me give you that quote exactly. Discussions with our insurance underwriters and claim experts find that Greenbrier Gunderson will see an estimated $300,000 annual increase in premiums for each year added to Oregon's current 10-year statute of ultimate repose for product liability. End of quote.
You know,
I'm not going to claim to be an economist or an insurance expert before you. You know, the word that comes to my mind is poppycock, but I'm just going to suggest to you that you ought to be extremely skeptical of that, because we all know that Gunderson rail cars are on rail tracks all over the United States. I've never heard of a product liability claim against a rail car. Doesn't mean there couldn't be one, but I've never heard of it. I've been doing this for 35 years. If somebody is telling them that's what they're going to do to their liability insurance rates, I think they ought to shop around.
Thank you. All right, I've got a panel that I want to bring up, make sure we have enough time, and that includes Tom Holt, Kevin Mannix, Josh Palmer, and Don Miner. And JL, you're on here too. I didn't see that you're also, so I'm going to ask you to, if you wouldn't mind, are you okay, or did you want to come up too?
No.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition, testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 307. But before I address the substance of the bill, I do want to say that, you know, I don't think any reasonable person could fail to have compassion for the people that have just been up here. But we need to look at the broader policy issue here that's addressed in the law. The current law provides for a 10-year statute of repose from the date of the product going, being purchased. Within that, there's a 2-year limitation on when an action must be brought. The 10 years is the outer limit. So if one discovers the injury at 7 years and 364 days, and you have until, you know, the 9th year and 364 days to file the action. If the injury occurred inside beyond 8 years and but within the 10 years, the 10 years still applies. That reflects a policy judgment that this legislature, like other state legislatures, has made to strike a balance between where the manufacturer should be responsible for a product defect and where wear and tear and responsible maintenance takes over. Now, states approach product liability in a number of ways, and it's very important to recognize that the statute of repose is not the only factor. Other states have caps on punitive damages. We do not. Other states have differing statutes of repose because they have other elements that balance out products liability. Taken as a whole, the policy objective is to provide some predictability in the marketplace and in the courts for manufacturers so that reasonable responsibility can be applied. This legislature has consistently upheld the idea of having a reasonable statute of ultimate repose. When specific products have been a problem, this legislature has also struck reasonable balance by making specific exceptions to the law, and you've heard about some of those. This is an economic competitiveness issue. I have submitted for the record the letter that Senator Whitsitt referenced from Gunderson. They're a member of our coalition. I've also submitted a letter for the record from the Oregon Medical Association, and I believe you'll be receiving some others for the record if you have not already. I'd just like to highlight a key point in the Gunderson letter, and that is that they have much different statutes, and they have to assess, you know, where they can manufacture their product based on that. Their estimate, as Senator Whitsitt noted, is that based on their feedback from their insurer, that they would have a very substantial additional cost just on their liability insurance if this statute were to change. Their estimate is that it would go up by about $300,000 annually. Now, you can do your own math to how many jobs that translates into. The fact of the matter is we are in a very, very difficult economic environment. I think we all know people who have lost their jobs or their companies are hanging on by their fingernails. And this is a very bad time to experiment on the product liability system in Oregon that's been in place for some time. Several sessions ago, the business community joined with the trial bar to arrive upon the present statute. That was the result of a compromise because there was a court case that took the in practical effect, took the statute of repose down to an unreasonably short time, and everyone agreed that it was too short, and we came up with the present statute. We have been back in every session since about this very issue. So we would suggest that at the present time, that the best course of action for this legislature is to leave the statute as it is. Certainly extending it out to 25 years is a very long time, and the retroactivity proposal is particularly damaging. And with that, I'd be happy to turn it over to one of my fellow panelists or take questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Josh Palmer. I'm employed by Daimler Trucks North America. I'm an attorney for the company. Thank you for allowing me to testify here today in opposition to SB 307. I'll try to be short in my comments and hopefully not too repetitive of Tom's. But we think the timing for a bill like this in a proposed expansion of the statute of ultimate repose probably couldn't come at a worse time for the state's product manufacturers. And I guess it's not just manufacturers that are potentially affected by a dramatic expansion of the statute of ultimate repose as is being proposed by this bill. We're talking about dealers, distributors, basically anybody who's in the chain of distribution of a product who can be sued under the state's or product liability laws. I think it's an unassailable fact or assumption that we all have to make that if this bill passes, we will see increased litigation involving the state's product manufacturers, dealers, and distributors. I don't think there's any question about that, and I think whatever side of the fence you're on this bill, you would have to acknowledge that. Increased litigation, probably stating the obvious, equates to increased defense costs, increased exposure, and increased insurance premiums and rates. I'm not in a position to talk to translate that to real-world dollars, but I think the negative impact to Daimler Trucks in North America and to the other manufacturers within this, dealers and distributors within this state, are certainly real and not just theoretical. There will be a negative impact. And again, in the broader context of where we are today, and the reason why I make my comment that the timing couldn't be worse is, again, hopefully not, well, I know I'm stating the obvious when I say the economic climate for product manufacturers is about as bad as it's ever been, or certainly as it's been in recent history. Daimler Trucks in particular, and by the way, I should have noted this at the outset, we are, dependent upon the day, I think the largest commercial vehicle manufacturer in the country. We are part of Daimler AG's truck group, which is far and away the largest commercial vehicle manufacturer in the world. Our industry here in the United States and in the NAFTA region has been in a protracted downturn since 2007. So much is made in the news about the big three and the woes affecting them, which in relative terms is a fairly recent problem. We've been in a downturn since early 2007, so we're staring in the face our third year of a substantial downturn in our business. So again, I think you can understand where we come from in opposing this bill. More higher costs to our company within this state, and frankly, to any manufacturer, whether they're in or out of this state, and putting that burden on the shoulders of manufacturers, dealers, and distributors at this point in time, to me, does not send a positive message to not only the corporations and businesses that who are already resident in this state, but if we step back and think about what is the state trying to do, what messages is the state trying to send to other companies that the state is trying to woo, that the state is in the process of courting to bring into this state. I can tell you that one of the considerations, and I'm not going to look you in the face and tell you it's necessarily the primary consideration, but certainly one of the considerations of any manufacturer is going to be the tort landscape within that state. Again, I don't think that can be argued with. A statute of repose and a dramatic expansion of the statute of repose that we're talking about here certainly does not send a message to corporations who may be looking to reside in this state that this is a very receptive and friendly environment for their interests. I think it sends the exact opposite message. So I think that should be, Daimler Trucks believes that should be considered by this committee and the legislature as you consider all of the impacts, the potential impacts of this bill. I'll try to bring my comments to a close in 1 minute, but I just want to talk about, we also believe there's a fundamental fairness issue here. When you, and let's take an example. Let's bring this from the abstract to the real world. Again, we're a truck manufacturer, among other things. We make school buses, RV chassis, step vans, you know, you name it, we probably make it in terms of commercial vehicles. Under this bill, we could have a 22-year-old truck that's still running around out there. And remember that if the statute of repose is expanded to 25 years and we're sued for design or alleged design or manufacturing defects, we may be talking about design decisions that were made 35 years ago, right? So when we're confronted with a case like that, you know, while the plaintiff does have the burden of proof, we understand that. The reality is we have to defend the decision-making that occurred in this case, in this example, 25, 30, 35 years ago. How do you do that? You go out and you try to find corporate witnesses. Well, in the case of a product that may have been designed 35 years ago, those folks are likely going to be retired and unavailable, deceased. The documents may well no longer exist. And then in the case of a truck that's lived for 25 years, it's probably been owned by multiple folks. It probably has the fingerprints of hundreds and hundreds of people on it in terms of the folks who have repaired, maintained, perhaps modified that truck, installed aftermarket equipment. These are all things that could have a dramatic impact on the original condition of that truck. And from a practical standpoint, we have no way of identifying those folks or gathering information, you know, about what they may have done or not done to that vehicle. So, again, we think that's why the states that have enacted statutes of repose, I don't believe there is one that has one as long as 25 years. I believe the longest one out there is 15 years, and the vast majority of them fall into the 8 to 10-year range. I can supplement the record with actual statutes if you would like that. I don't have that in front of me today. I don't believe there's a state out there today with a statute of repose anywhere close to 25 years. I do have some written testimony that I would like to supplement the record with, and I've already submitted that. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in private practice in Salem. I'm not here today on behalf of any particular client. I am here as a former short-term senator and long-term state representative and as a citizen advocate. I'm also here as someone who, across the way, in the early 1990s, sponsored legislation to let victims of child sex abuse be able to go back and bring lawsuits against the perpetrators. We opened the door because we saw there was a need for justice, and we saw that the justice system did not address their needs or their concerns and did not legitimize them. And they were children when they were victimized. So we changed the statute that reopened the door when they came into adulthood. Not here to testify about that, but I'm mentioning it because we are dealing with a tragic situation and we addressed it. So there are times when the legislature needs to address these situations. In 1999, my last regular session as a legislator, I teamed up with and assisted now Senator Jackie Winters, then Representative Jackie Winters, in proceeding with legislation that allowed a certain individual or any other individuals who have been harmed by certain extension equipment that worked with high-powered lines to bring claims after the old-fashioned statute of limitations and ultimate repose had ended. Had closed out those claims. Why? Because we found that those manufacturers were presenting those vehicles as having a much longer life. There was documentation that they were doing that. So we said, wait a minute, you're selling this stuff on the basis it's good for 20 years or whatever, so you're going to be liable because that's how you market it. But we wrote a carefully crafted, narrow piece of legislation, Chapter 514, Oregon Laws, 1999, that addressed that issue. Retrospectively, in a way, because we really reopened the doors. But retroactivity is a very dangerous thing. In that case, we felt that the interest of justice, as the evidence was presented to us, called for retroactivity because someone was not, in effect, getting the benefit of the bargain, the representation about the longevity and useful life of the equipment. Otherwise, though, retroactivity is dangerous because there's unpredictability in the marketplace. And nobody knows when Oregon is again going to say, by the way, we're going to reopen the barn doors for anybody to come forward. And the retroactivity clause does that here in the eyes of manufacturers, distributors across the nation. But I'd like to swing back to today and today's economy in Oregon. The governor says, and I agree with this, that he has a goal of Oregon being the leading state in the nation for green manufacturing, for green power, for doing things in an environmentally sensitive way. How are we going to convince companies to situate in Oregon and develop solar manufacturing devices, other green devices, if they know that we are the worst case in the nation in terms of the potential that if something goes wrong with their equipment down the pike, they can be sued here? I'll make up an example. You're a solar panel manufacturer. You're looking at coming to Oregon. Suddenly, the statute of ultimate repose has moved to, say, 25 years. And if you're here, that means you can be sued every time that happens because you're here. So on some Texas back highway, 24 years from now, a solar panel fails and is powering an emergency telephone, and a motorist has just had his passenger suffering a heart attack, doesn't have a cell phone, goes to that solar panel phone, can't use it, says, ah, design defect or manufacturing defect in that solar panel. Therefore, I'm not only going to sue whoever set up the phone, whatever else, I've got a target. I'm going to go after that Oregon manufacturer of solar devices and say there was a design defect. How do they anticipate that? How do they buy insurance that covers it? And I believe what Gunderson has to say. The insurance companies are going to load it up saying, hey, we don't know when or where somebody may sue you for your product, and we're going to have to really insure you based on the volume of your business. So in wrapping up, my concern is that you target your solutions to specific problems that are identified and come up with solutions that give justice in those cases where something has gone wrong with the system, but that you not use the blunderbuss approach which is represented in this legislation, because it will harm today's workers who are looking for jobs, who want to have those jobs in those new industries, and we want to bring those industries to Oregon. It's not going to happen if we send a signal that we're open for business, but we're also open to shutting down business. And I can see it now. I can see that the green that we would have would be the green mold or the green moss growing on the closed doors of the manufacturing facilities that will leave Oregon, or worse yet, the greenery that grows because nothing was built there in terms of green industries. Maybe my hyperbole is going getting out of control here.
Yeah.
What I'm getting at is we need to understand that this is a major economic impact.
I need you to... All right. JL, I'm going to let you have a few minutes. I still have a panel that wants to be open to ask questions, so if you make your comments short and not repeat other testimony.
I'm on. Thank you, Chair members. For the record, my name is JL Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. We are also the affiliate for the National Association of Manufacturers. We are opposed to Senate Bill 307. We believe that the current statute is adequate in its current form. Extending the statute of repose on product liability suits beyond its current year, 8 years, we believe is unfair to manufacturers, harmful to Oregon's business climate, and ultimately, we view this as an employment issue, which the state has some skin in the game. That is, we are an income-dependent state. This issue is a big deal to Oregon's manufacturers that are a member of our association, whether you're talking about Daimler, Gunderson, ADEC, ESCO, the big manufacturers that provide family wage jobs in this state are clearly impacted by this legislation. When you get evidence from Gunderson that extending for every year extension is $300,000 increase in insurance costs, that has direct employment ramifications. And ultimately, as an income-dependent state in which we depend on these companies to produce family wage jobs, there is really something at stake for the state as well. For our companies, the issue is certainty. As you extend the timelines out, the statute of repose out, the evidence is less reliable. It's more difficult to collect after a long period of time. Witnesses become harder to locate. Evidence erodes. Evidence get lost. The defenses are generally harder to maintain. You have manufacturers who have maintained information about product design development and distribution are faced with new liabilities, but their capacity to defend themselves obviously becomes reduced. This is the central issue for the folks that we represent. We believe that this is precisely the wrong time to start opening the door for lawsuits because of the employment ramifications. We're at 9.9% right now in terms of unemployment. That's unacceptable. I don't think you can argue that this won't exaggerate the problem. So we would encourage the committee to look at the issue in that context. We support the statute in its current form.
Don?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of the Dash 1 Amendment. Our members build and sell manufactured homes and prefabricated structures in Oregon. There are 11 companies building these homes in Oregon. Just by way of background, a manufactured home is a home built in a factory to federal building standards. It's inspected by the state of Oregon under the supervision of the federal government. Prefabricated buildings are buildings built in factories to state of Oregon standards. They're built with the same materials, as technologies as other types of houses. After the work in the factory is completed, they're delivered to a building site where they're completed. Roofs are finished, foundations are put in place, etc. The real difference between these houses and other houses is, you know, not how they're built, but where they're built. I've given you a copy or an excerpt of ORS 12-135 that speaks to the limitations that other improvements to real property are subject to. The Dash 1 Amendment makes clear that manufactured homes and prefabricated structures would be subject to those same time limitations. Our industry is struggling, and we think that it's important to maintain a level playing field between the site-built industry and our industry. With that, I'd ask for your support of the Dash 1 Amendment.
All right, thank you. First, I'm going to ask, does anyone have any questions of Mr. Meyer? Don, thank you very much. All right, anyone have any questions? I'm going to continue. I'm going to go till 10 o'clock. I understand people may have other things that need to happen. So let's, any questions, comments? Senator Romici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think that the people from Gunderson are here, but somebody submitted this on their behalf, and I wanted to ask about the statement in the Gunderson testimony says that Gunderson has two major competitors, one in Alabama and then one in Texas, and that we were given some information about the statutes of ultimate repose in other states, and it's my understanding based on that information that in Alabama their statute of ultimate repose has been found unconstitutional, and I just wondered if you had any knowledge about that or comments about that.
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, we submitted that letter on behalf of Gunderson. I'm not a constitutional law expert either here or in Alabama, so I really don't have an answer to your question on that, but I'd be happy to get one and provide it to the committee.
Thank you very much.
All right. Gentlemen, I'm going to throw out some different points I heard made, and I want some comments if possible. Tom and Josh, you talk about broader policies and issues. We've got a list here that says 37 states currently have no ultimate repose statutes limiting when someone can go forward. And I understand that, Tom, you'd said something about tort reform in some of these other states. So I'm going to ask you to put together whatever you have or whatever you can get hold of as to showing what the all 50 states have as it pertains to tort reform and how that might compare on a cross comparison. My concern is when I hear the statements I've heard, I guess first the economic environment. When is a good time for us to do this? And I ask that in the context that I've been here 95, 97, 99, 2003, 2005, and 2007, and now I'm back. Many of those years were in the heyday, economic boom. But we didn't have the support that I'm hearing now that I may have if it was a better time to have a more open opportunity for fairness for individuals such as these teachers who had no control of their work environment, who basically have been able to demonstrate to the chair that they're basically being penalized because their related date is March is 1988 for the manufacturing date. And I hear
Josh, you're telling us as to the difficulty of going back and looking at the design that may be 35 years old. Where's the fairness there?
Well, I think it's a balance. And I think if you hark back to when the statute of repose was originally enacted, and don't quote me on this, but I believe it was in the 70s.
77.
What was going on, and I think the rationale that I note in my testimony as cited by the Oregon Supreme Court was to give Oregon's manufacturers, dealers, and distributors some level of stability and predictability. We've obviously alluded to that in our testimony. And, and the legislature obviously has to balance that against ensuring that other societal interests are taken into account. The interests of folks like some of the ones we heard today in ensuring that they can recover within reason on legitimate product-related claims. And again, it's probably not the answer you were looking for, but again, when the legislature struck that balance, we believe there was a good and compelling reason to do it at the time frame that they did. Frankly, what has changed in the 30 years? Is there more reason to today than there was back in the 70s to strike that balance where it was, and which recognizes the interests of the corporate interests within the state and balances it against the other societal interests? I mean, to me, in today's climate, economic climate, if anything, the reason for striking that balance where it was has become stronger today than it was back in the 1970s.
All right, thank you. Let me ask another question, and this is regarding the Philips light bulbs. We have testimony that said the change only cost the manufacturer 5 cents to put that element on there, so when the outside casing breaks, the light goes out in 15 minutes. 5 cents. What message do we send to the consumers that we're not requiring a manufacturer who knows of this issue to still allow them to sell those bulbs in this state?
Mr. Chairman, if I may jump in. Are you asking him or are you asking me?
I was asking Josh.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I have a hard time responding to the light bulb situation. I realize even the testimony we heard today, it seems like an unfair situation. I think of it in terms of the products that my company manufactures. And I talked about an example of a 20-year-old truck going back and trying to reconstruct the decision-making that occurred 20, 30 years ago, including...
Josh, I understand that. The question was, we talked about fundamental fairness. You brought it up. Is it fair for us as a state to allow a manufacturer who knows they have a defect to not correct it and put the other bulbs out here and only those bulbs in the state when the cost to the manufacturer is 5 cents, and I'd love to know what they're actually charging for the cost of that 5 cent item being added to that product, because we've already heard it costs more than the other lights, and they're keeping them on the market because they can't afford them. And it's kind of like, and Kevin, you can get on this, the Ford Pinto with the rear gas tank.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer that question. In fact, why isn't Oregon, and given situations like that, passing legislation that forbids the sale of that product? We're talking of the real justice fits both ways. One is retrospective, the other is prospective. If a product is dangerous, we should have a mechanism in place to forbid its sale. And if Philips is selling a light bulb today in Oregon that is dangerous, where is the legislation to stop that for the future? Where is the legislation to call for dealers to check their inventories and to pull it from their shelves? The problem we're talking about today is using the statute of ultimate repose, which is a retrospective device, to try to protect people in the future. And the only way you can do that, figuratively, is to beat some people over the head for having not been careful enough in the past after somebody's been injured. Now, we could have a special product safety commission. We have done it with lead, involving products that children will have contact with. There are a variety of devices that can be taken to protect people from this happening in the future, and they should affect all manufacturers. That's predictable. That can be put into the cost of manufacturing and distribution.
And so what you're suggesting is that the state take over what the federal government has already got in place, and we should have our own bureaucratic process of doing that?
Mr. Chairman, actually, in some cases, Oregon can do a much better job than the federal government.
I agree with that.
I have a question.
Yes, go right ahead.
Sure. Nobody has the answer, but I would be curious if somebody can provide it to my office as to where these light bulbs are manufactured. I mean, just because it's Philips, are these done in China, Indonesia, the United States, Alabama? I'm just curious at some point in the future.
We'll see if we can get an answer. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on a comment that the chair made about the timing of things. And I think right now what's really critical is to build consumer confidence. And I think if we send a message, as the chair said, that people like Stephen have to go to places like Wisconsin to get his day in court, I think that affects consumer confidence. And I also wanted to comment on what you said, Mr. Mannix, about the work that you did to let victims of child sex abuse sue despite the statute of limitations. I don't think that a piecemeal approach is best. I know that the side gas tanks was done piecemeal. I think it's better for businesses to have the predictability of knowing, yes, everyone still has to prove their case under the law. That this doesn't allow people to recover. It allows people to have their day in court. But frankly, when you were talking about the victims of child sex abuse and allowing them to sue, I thought to myself, the people who testified here today have just as much of a compelling reason to be able to recover as victims of child sex abuse. So I don't know if you want to respond to that.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you can take any given scenario. Can take the testimony of the victims of tragic circumstances who have come in here today, and you can say, well, let's take a look at that and see whether or not retrospectively those specific kinds of circumstances need to be addressed. Is Case out there manufacturing and distributing tractors that have a dangerous design defect in them and historically they were selling them saying they're good for 30 years? I mean, is there a case to be made for a specific addressed answer to that? In terms of the child sex abuse cases, we did not say that anyone who becomes an adult can sue anybody for whatever happened to them as a child. We dealt with sex abuse because there was secrecy and shame involved, and children who were abused in those circumstances were often convinced that they shouldn't tell anybody. When they became adults, they became aware of the harm, and we opened the door for those circumstances, not because a child fell off a bicycle or because a child openly harmed by somebody else, because those were situations that weren't shameful to the child, and maybe they shouldn't have been, but that's the way they felt. That's the way they were made to feel by the perpetrators and the secrecy. So there are special circumstances that do need to be addressed. This bill does not address special circumstances.
All right.
Chair Pozanski, if I may address your question and Senator Bonamici's question in regards to timing. There is a fundamental issue here with the bill in that it is looking only at one aspect of products liability. I think all of us would be happy to engage in a broader discussion of liability, the whole matrix of things. If we look at just this, then we have a real problem. But if we're you were willing to entertain things like damage caps, I think there'd be a lot of people anxious to be around the table about that.
Well, you've looked at, we've attempted to have the voters deal with that on two different votes, which were turned down. And the last time the proponents of that attempted to actually get the signatures, they weren't able to do that. So we can continue the discussions. And as I put on the record, Mr. Holt, we'll have those discussions after this session's over in some type of work group, interim work group. But I'm going to expect you and anyone else who's coming to the table from whatever perspective to have an open mind, a clean slate, or we're not going to go there, because I'm not going to waste my time or any of my committee members' time to just basically have hit. It's our way or the highway. All right, with that, is there any other questions? Thank you very much, and we're adjourned for today.